And that talk was brought to me via the Active Ingredients website. That's activeingredients.org. Now, we continue with the New Pearl Harbor, Part 4, The Pentagon.
According to the 9/11 Commission, the airplane that appeared over Washington and went on to strike the Pentagon was Flight American 77, the same plane that had disappeared from radar screens over West Virginia almost 1 hour before. But they never provided any evidence of that. As we have seen, the flight data recorder's serial number that could have identified the airplane was never released. All the debunkers have to show for Flight 77 is a small piece of wreckage carrying an American Airlines serial number. But this piece could have been placed by anyone onto the grass after the impact. In fact, unidentified men in suits were seen meddling with the debris right after the impact, in direct violation of the rules of a crime scene. A contractor who was only 100 yards away from the point of impact stated, "It was DPS, the guys in the black coats. They were here right then and there. That's what I don't understand. Where did they come from? Maybe they knew something. I don't know." The debunkers claim that the witnesses' accounts are more than sufficient to identify the airplanes.
Hundreds of people saw an American Airlines jet fly into that building.
But it's presumable that if anyone wanted a different airplane to look like an American Airlines aircraft, they would have at least thought of painting the fuselage with the same colors. The majority of witnesses recall seeing a large airliner. But there are also witnesses who describe a much smaller, executive-like airplane.
I was just casually looking out the corner, out of the window. In the corner of my eye, I saw what looked to be maybe a 20-passenger corporate jet, no markings on the side.
From my office, I was able to see a white jet, like a Gulfstream-type commuter jet, I guess.
Omar, you say this was a smaller plane, 10 to 15 passengers, maybe?
No es muy grande.
No es muy grande.
Is it not like too big? It's just.
Tú sabes los aviones comerciales?
Is it like it like business aeroplane?
Like a business jet.
Yeah.
It looked like a commuter plane, two engines come down from the south, real low, proceed right on and crash right into the Pentagon.
And are you fairly sure that it was what we sometimes describe and recognize as a small commuter plane?
Yes, it was.
By the witnesses' accounts alone, it's impossible to establish what kind of airplane it was. As the plane clipped five light poles before striking the Pentagon, the debunkers maintain that the distance between the light poles indicates a corridor wide enough that only a large airliner could have created it.
This is Paolo Atavissimo. We find some light poles down, five of them. Altogether, they represent a stripe 26 meters wide. Let's pretend we don't know it was an airplane. We do know that something 26 meters wide went by.
26 meters is roughly 85 feet, but the wingspan of a 757 is 124 feet, which means any airplane with an 85-foot wingspan could have downed those light poles. It didn't need to be a 757.
The missing airplane.
In fact, with a 100-ton airliner hitting a reinforced concrete building like the Pentagon, one would expect to find a situation similar to this. What immediately stood out instead was the absence of large, identifiable pieces of debris, which are usually found after the crash of an airliner. Bob Pugh was the first professional cinematographer to arrive on site.
No one was in control of the area. I have free rein. And there's a lot of debris in the foreground of those videos. Again, very small pieces. I mean, I'm standing on pieces, a dinner plate or smaller in size. All the while, I'm looking for wreckage, and I can't find a piece of anything that I recognize. I can't see the tail. I can't see the wheels. I can't see the engines. There's no chairs. There's no luggage.
According to the debunkers, there are no large pieces of debris on the lawn because most of the airplane ended up inside the building.
The large part of the debris is not outside because the plane went inside the building. The official version.
Purdue University has produced a detailed computer animation illustrating the official version of the event.
Mette Sosen, professor of civil engineering at Purdue University.
We had the plans for the Pentagon, all the details, right down to the last reinforcing bar. The speed of the airplane and the direction from which came was given to us by the Transport Safety Institute.
According to the official version, the plane approached in a low trajectory, clipping five light poles from the nearby intersection. Slightly tilted to the left, it hit a trailer parked outside the building with the bottom of the right wing, and then impacted the facade at an angle of 42 degrees. Most of the plane penetrated the facade and proceeded inside the building on a diagonal course, causing destruction as it was being destroyed. The fuselage pierced through the outer wall of the C-ring, producing this round-shaped exit hole 10 to 12 feet wide. There are, however, many problems with this version of the events. The first one is the actual wingspan of a Boeing 757. Most of us remember the facade of the Pentagon after it had collapsed. But before it collapsed, right after the impact, this is what the building looked like. This series of pictures was taken by a Navy photographer shortly after the impact. There doesn't seem to be enough damage for a Boeing 757 to have penetrated the building almost in full. Using the best part from each image, a digital expert has created this composite picture, which has become the universal tool of reference for anyone involved in the debate. The composite picture shows an almost continuous opening at ground level, about 90 feet wide. The damage extends to the second floor, with an entry hole about 15 feet wide. This is enough, maintain the debunkers, to have accommodated most of the plane inside the building.
Jérôme Quiron, debunker. People ask, how did it get inside? But if we look at some pictures taken at different moments, which have been assembled, they allow us to see the actual gash on the facade. One can see the entire ground floor has been destroyed for 30 meters across. And then, of course, in the middle, you have the hole from the fuselage. This is David Dunbar from Popular Mechanics.
That gash in the E-ring was about 90 feet across. The wingspan of the plane was about 124 and change. That punched the hole into the building.
It is true. The wingspan of a 757 is 124 feet. But the debunkers forget that the plane came in at a 42-degree angle, which makes the projected wingspan on the facade 160 feet wide. That's almost twice the 90-foot existing gash. As shown in this animation, the left wing should have also destroyed these two windows to the left of the opening. But the whole segment to the left of the opening doesn't seem to have been hit by a wing traveling at 500 miles per hour. The window's wooden frames are still in place, and the glass seems to have been broken from the ensuing explosion, not from the impact itself. The limestone covering the facade has fallen off, but the bricks underneath appear practically untouched. By the same projected angle, the right wing should have impacted the facade all the way to this column on the second floor. In fact, there is a diagonal cut on the second floor wall that could have resulted from the wing's impact. But this puts most of the wing above the second floor slab, which means it never penetrated the facade to begin with. So where did it go? This is the explanation by Popular Mechanics for what happened to the wings.
The wings did not fully penetrate the facade. In fact, the wings had already been partially sheared off by the time the plane even hit the building.
David Coburn from Popular Mechanics.
The fuselage, mainly, made the hole that existed. Conspiracy theorists want to know why it wasn't the width of the full wingspan of the plane, and actually just the simple reason was that the wings came off.
But where did they go? Popular Mechanics doesn't say. A similar problem is posed by the horizontal stabilizers, which extend some 50 feet in width. As they are mounted 3 feet higher than the wings, they should have impacted the facade approximately here and here. But there are no visible marks from their impact on the facade, nor is any recognizable piece of the stabilizers visible on the lawn. Same story for the tail, which raises 24 feet above the fuselage. At the time of impact, the tail should have hit as high as the windows on the fourth floor. The Purdue animation shows the tail entering the building in full, as if it were cutting through butter. But the facade above the entry hole doesn't show any significant damage, and the glass from the windows around the hole isn't even broken. For the missing tail and stabilizers, Popular Mechanics offers this generic explanation.
A plane flying 500 miles an hour, hitting a concrete wall that is extremely reinforced, there's not going to be much left of it. You're not going to see it sitting on the lawn of the Pentagon in one or two or three pieces.
But here is the problem. If part of the wings, the stabilizers, and the tail disintegrated against the facade, how could the fuselage penetrate it almost entirely? The fuselage is by far the weakest part of the plane, as it basically consists of an empty cylinder meant to carry the passengers and their belongings. How fragile the fuselage is, compared to the wings, is explained by aviation expert Jacques Roland.
Jacques Roland,
former general of the Air Force, is today the best expert in airplane crashes in the courts of law. It's not easy to understand that when you have a front impact, the whole thing crumbles at the speed of penetration. The first hard point is here. He's pointing the beginning of the wings, where they're joined onto the fuselage. Until you get here, the airplane is like paper.
Question. How could the fuselage, which is the weakest part of the plane, penetrate the facade almost entirely, while part of the wings, the stabilizers, and the tail, which are relatively stronger, were unable to do so and were shattered in 1,000 pieces instead? Even more mysterious is the disappearance of the engines. The 757 that allegedly hit the Pentagon was equipped with two RB211 engines built by Rolls-Royce. Almost 8 feet in height, weighing over 7,000 pounds each, the internal core of the engine is made with components so sturdy and resistant that they are considered practically indestructible.
Andy Murray, Chief Design Engineer.
That's a rotator at 10,000 revolutions per minute, with a blade speed of about 800 miles per hour.
To operate at around 1,700 degrees, they're designed not to melt.
Which parts never get destroyed, never melt from the heat? This is pilot Giancarlo Tedeschi. Parts of the landing gear and the core of the two engines, which is much more compact than the outer part of the engine. It's built with materials that must withstand the temperatures, 3,600 to 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit. The core of the two engines must have certainly survived the impact.
But where are they? In their animation, Purdue University has chosen to ignore the issue. As one can see, moments before the impact, the two engines simply vanish into thin air. Debunker Paolo Attivissimo has made what he calls a cautious suggestion.
This is an RB211 Rolls-Royce engine, and this is an object found in front of the Pentagon. As I was saying before, probably the engines didn't penetrate completely. This object has a compatible shape. I'll be cautious. I'll simply say the shape is compatible.
But this rotor could have come from any engine. There is also another picture of a similar disc, or possibly the same disc, from a different angle. And then there is this part of an engine found inside the Pentagon. But we are not looking for scraps. We are looking for 2 3-ton pieces of machinery made with steel and titanium that after an accident should look something like this.
These are much larger chunks.
Or like this.
Recognizable as engines.
In fact, had the Pentagon been hit by a 757, the two engines would have impacted the facade around these two points, just below the wings. This means they would have proceeded inside the building on a path somewhat parallel to the fuselage, carving a trail of destruction much more devastating than any other part of the plane.
Is the engine that kind of a bullet? Yeah, absolutely. It can easily be likened to a bullet. Hurled at 500 miles per hour, the structure pushes on. No obstacle can stop it.
But there are no engines visible outside the exit hole, nor are there any other holes in the wall that could have been caused by an engine. Question. Can you explain what happened to the core of the two engines, which is built with components so strong and resistant to be considered practically indestructible? Now for the biggest mystery of all, the exit hole. According to the official version, it was the fuselage of the plane that created this hole in the wall of the C-ring. On September 15, 2001, the Pentagon renovation manager stated, "The plane penetrated through the E-ring, D-ring, C-ring. The nose of the plane just barely broke through the inside of the C-ring, so it was extending into AE drive a little bit." The AE drive is the internal alley separating the C-ring from the B-ring. But how could the fuselage have made it all the way through the wall of the C-ring?
A 120-ton airplane traveling at 500 miles an hour impacts a facade and pierces through it. As it proceeds, it gets ground by the columns along its path, as if it's going through a grinder of sorts, and what's left are only very small fragments. Whatever's left reaches the opposite side.
If the fuselage is only a cylinder and it gets cut and ground by the columns in 1,000 pieces, how can it retain the circular shape needed to punch this almost perfectly round hole in the wall? This is where the explanations by the debunkers become absolutely fascinating.
Jim Miggs of Popular Mechanics.
The mass of the plane penetrated the building with enormous energy and continued into the building in a state almost more like a liquid than a solid.
Alan Kilschmeyer, debunker.
Then encountered reinforced concrete columns 2 feet thick, so the aircraft was flying through a forest of columns.
The plane became almost like an artillery shell or a tank round. What actually came out, it was a circular ball of fire, which is how fire goes when it moves. That's why it has a perfectly round shape.
By this time, there was an avalanche of debris that was moving as a single mass, much as in an avalanche of snow.
Whether it was a liquid mass, a ball of fire, or an avalanche of snow, all these hypotheses are flatly contradicted by the Pentagon Building Performance Report, a document published in 2003 by the American Society of Civil Engineers. In assessing the condition of the columns on the first floor, the report reads, columns 3G, 3H, 3J, and 5J were damaged but still standing, although in the direct path of the fuselage. It is highly unlikely that any significant portion of the fuselage could have retained structural integrity at this point in its travel. The aircraft frame most certainly was destroyed before it had traveled a distance that approximately equaled the length of the aircraft. The length of the aircraft is 155 feet, which is roughly half the distance between the entry and the exit holes. That no substantial part of the fuselage reached the wall of the C-ring was also confirmed by the first eyewitnesses who described the damage inside the Pentagon.
John Jester from Defense Protection Services.
So the plane went in up to the E, D, and to the C-ring. Not all the way through the C-ring.
Question. Given that, according to the Pentagon Building Performance Report, the aircraft frame most certainly was destroyed before it had traveled a distance that approximately equaled the length of the aircraft, and that it is highly unlikely that any significant portion of the fuselage could have retained structural integrity from that point on, can you explain what caused the almost perfectly round exit hole in the outer wall of the C-ring? In conclusion, we have an opening on the first floor that's a bit more than half the projected wingspan of a 757. The tip of the left wing and most of the right wing missing without a valid explanation. The horizontal stabilizers and the tail also missing without a valid explanation. A fuselage that behaved more like a warhead than an empty cylinder made with aluminum. No trace whatsoever of the core of the two engines and an exit hole on the C-ring that no one can rationally explain. Given all these facts, we must conclude that the damage observed at the Pentagon is not compatible with and must have been created by something other than a Boeing 757.
The missing tapes.
The mystery of what hit the Pentagon could have been easily solved if the FBI had released the videos from dozens of surveillance cameras that are placed all around the impact zone.
Matt Sullivan, 9/11 researcher.
Yeah, there were a lot of cameras around the Pentagon. If you look at the Pentagon, you can see that there's cameras on each corner. There's cameras at some of the businesses around the Pentagon. And we know in those cases, the tapes were confiscated immediately by the FBI within hours of the event.
When a Freedom of Information Act requesting all the videos covering the impact zone was filed, the FBI agent in charge of the tapes responded, "The FBI possessed 85 videotapes that might be potentially responsive to plaintiff's FOIA request." But, concluded the agent, "I determined that only one videotape showed the impact of Flight 77 into the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. This is the tape we have all seen many, many times." The FBI could have released all the videos anyway, just to allow the public to see by themselves what was actually shown in each of them. But for some reason, they preferred to keep them under wraps.
Michael Moore, filmmaker.
I've filmed before down at the Pentagon, before 9/11. There's got to be at least 100 video cameras ringing that building, in the trees, everywhere. They've got that plane coming in with 100 angles. I want to see the video. I want to see 100 videos that exist of this. Why don't they want us to see that plane coming into the building?
Not only has this question never been answered, but an in-depth analysis of the only footage of the impact ever released contains a dramatic surprise. Initially, the DOD released these five frames taken from a Pentagon parking security camera. Later on, in 2006, the DOD released the entire sequence from which the five frames had been extracted. The time-lapse sequence runs at approximately one frame per second, and it shows the moments leading up to the impact, the large explosion, and a billowing fire that ensued. Unfortunately, the video does not show the airplane in transit. All we can see in the frame preceding the explosion is what appears to be the tail of an airplane followed by a trail of white smoke. But the body of the plane remains covered by this concrete column standing in the foreground. The Department of Defense also released a second video, taken by a different camera from the same parking lot. The second camera was actually located in the very column that obscured the view of the plane in the first video. This aerial shot of the Pentagon shows the actual location of the two cameras. The second camera faces in the same direction as the first, and it offers a clear, unobstructed view of the same field of action. By using the moment of the explosion, we can synchronize the two cameras with absolute frame-by-frame accuracy. By synchronizing the two cameras, we notice that the second video begins earlier than the first, while the first lasts longer than the second. This leaves us with a middle, common section of about 100 frames, which are perfectly synchronized with each other. From the moment the police car moves on, the action proceeds in an identical manner both in the frames preceding the explosion and in those following the explosion. Especially in the second part of the videos, after the explosion, we can verify how each couple of frames depicts exactly the same action by looking at the shape of the billowing smoke. This confirms that the two cameras were operating in perfect synchronization. This is only to be expected. After all, the two cameras were controlled by a centralized recording system called multiplexer, or TLR. There is, however, one pair of frames from the two videos that shows a completely different action from one another. They happen to be the two frames in which the plane travels across the lawn. It's frame 23 in the relative count. As the first video showed the tail and the trail of smoke, we would expect the second camera placed in this concrete column to show the entire body of the plane in the same position. It does not. In the corresponding frame, camera 2 shows only the tip of the plane entering frame from the right-hand corner. But how can the nose of the plane be behind the tail at the same moment in time? The synchronization system allows for a maximum fluctuation between the two cameras, or margin of error, of 1/30th of a second. Given that the plane is traveling at 750 feet per second, the maximum possible fluctuation between the two cameras would translate into a difference of a mere 25 feet in the position of the plane. A 757 is 155 feet long. Even calculating the perspective due to the diagonal path, this is far from sufficient to explain the large discrepancy between the two images. Furthermore, after this moment, the two videos resume their perfect synchronization, which is maintained all the way to the end. Why these two crucial frames, and only these two, are so different from one another has puzzled researchers and digital experts alike. The same digital expert who had prepared the universal image from the Pentagon has also conducted an in-depth technical analysis of the two videos released by the Department of Defense. After confirming that the two cameras were synchronized by the same multiplexer system, this expert has compiled a table comparing the contents of each pair of frames. As one can see, frame 23 is the only one showing a strong inconsistency between the two images. The expert has then proceeded to analyze the two frames with the most sophisticated digital tools and has obtained some astonishing results. A series of Boolean subtractions reveals that a small part of the image is actually present in both frames. What is said to be the nose of the airplane in camera 2 is also present as part of the smoke trail in camera 1. It seems, in fact, as if someone has retouched this area of the frame by means of cut and paste in order to cover the plane, while he has kept the end of the smoke trail to make it look like the nose of the plane entering frame. Question. Given that the maximum fluctuation between the two cameras would translate in a difference of 25 feet in the position of the plane, can you provide a valid explanation for the large discrepancy between the two corresponding frames? Absent a valid explanation for this discrepancy, we must conclude that at least one of the two frames is the result of intentional manipulation or photoshopping. If we now summarize the situation at the Pentagon, we have the total lack of evidence that the unknown incoming was in fact Flight 77, a mysterious phantom plane that attracted the attention in the opposite direction, the failure from the White House to shoot down the incoming even though it posed a serious and imminent threat, a totally illogical approach maneuver from a terrorist's point of view, an alleged hijacker incapable of performing that maneuver, the absence of any significant part of the plane from the wreckage, a damage to the building clearly incompatible with a 757, a doctored tape of the impact, and the obvious reluctance by the FBI to release any other tape that could allow the identification of the plane.
Part 5, Flight 93.
The whole issue of Flight 93 basically boils down to one question. If you just happened to drive by and someone told you that a Boeing 757 has just crashed into this hole and most of the 100-ton airliner is now buried under the ground, would you believe it or not? This is the kind of puzzlement the people from Shanksville experienced when they arrived on the crash site of Flight 93.
Rick King, a firefighter from Shanksville.
We drove back that road, and where the road ended, that's where the plane was. And, I mean, you know, the only thing I could tell, you know, I get out, you know, like I said, I heard this thing, you know, I felt the explosion, saw the fireball, and I get up there, and I'm thinking, where is it, you know? Just debris, pieces, small pieces of debris, and you know, the trees were singed and burning, it was just smoldering.
Nothing. It was just little pieces. There was nothing to actually, like a door or a window or anything, you couldn't really, it was just little pieces of shrapnel everywhere.
What's that right there? Over in here.
TV reporters were also at a loss when faced with the idea that an actual plane had just crashed on that site.
Jim Parsons, WTAE-TV from Pittsburgh.
You know, at first I wasn't even sure that this was, that these were pieces of the plane. They're so small, and it's indistinguishable. You can't tell whether it's a piece of the fuselage or a piece of the seats. You don't know what it is.
Chris Kanicki, he's a photographer. He was back there just a couple of minutes ago, and Chris, I've seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground.
Basically, that's right. From where we could see, there wasn't much left.
Any large pieces of debris at all?
No, there was nothing that you could distinguish that a plane had crashed there.
Eddie Magnus, NBC News.
It's really all you see is a large crater in the ground and just tiny, tiny bits of debris.
Alert also went out to Somerset County Coroner Wallace Miller. He hurried to the scene, an abandoned strip mine. When he arrived, he couldn't believe his eyes.
It looked like someone had gouged about a 10-foot wide, 10-foot deep trough through the strip mine area. But when you looked in, it was just covered with dirt. There was nothing there that you could really say was an airplane.
Dennis Roddy was the editor-in-chief of the Pittsburgh Gazette.
Airplane debris? Nothing I could identify.
Possibly the most disconcerted of all was the mayor of Shanksville, Ernie Stuhl.
Ja, mein Schwager und ein guter Freund von mir waren die Ersten hier. Sie haben in Shanksville an einer Straßenecke gestanden und sich unterhalten. Ihr Wagen stand gleich in der Nähe und so waren sie die Ersten hier. Dann kam erst die Feuerwehr. Alle waren wie vor den Kopf gestoßen, weil sie zu einem Flugzeugabsturz gerufen wurden.
No airplane.
Nein, da war nichts. Nur dieses Loch. Ich dachte immer, das sei die Absturzstelle. Das ist sie, aber da ist nichts zu sehen.
It's in that hole, says the FBI, that most of the airplane lays literally buried in the ground. Much of the plane and its contents were found beneath the soft dirt, states the FBI's website. Evidence technicians found the flight data recorder about 12 feet below the surface and the cockpit voice recorder about 25 feet deep. Since the two black boxes are located in the tail of the plane, one must conclude that also the cockpit, most of the fuselage, the passengers' seats and bodies and their belongings somehow managed to get buried deep underground. The only ones who don't seem to have a problem with this explanation are the debunkers.
Jim Miggs, editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics.
We have this idea that when planes crash, they crack in half and there's this dramatic burned wreckage. That's what happens when planes crash at very low speeds, usually on approach or takeoff from an airport. This plane was flying straight down. It was approaching the speed of sound. It would have if it had gone much farther. And it penetrated into soft ground with incredible velocity.
Massimo Polidoro, debunker, says this was a different kind of crash. The plane was almost vertical when it crashed and at an extremely high speed. The plane almost pressed itself into the ground, producing a small crater, and whatever is left ends up mostly into the ground.
First of all, it isn't true that the plane hit the ground almost vertically. According to the NTSB flight path, the 757 hit the ground at an angle of about 45 degrees. This fact alone removes much of the exceptionality the debunkers would like to attach to this crash. But even if it were true that the plane fell almost vertically, how could the hole have closed itself up even before the first responders arrived? This is not mud. This is your typical hard country soil. When a plane crashes and makes a hole in the ground, the hole remains open and quite visible from above. This, for example, is the crater caused by Flight Pan Am 103 when it crashed in Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. It's true that the 747, the plane that crashed in Lockerbie, is larger than a 757. But it's also true that the Pan Am flight broke up in midair due to an explosion, and that only part of the plane caused the crater seen in the photographs. Let's compare the size of the Lockerbie crater, several blocks wide, with the one in Shanksville, several feet wide. This is the size of a human being next to the Lockerbie crater. This is the size of a human being next to the Shanksville crater. These are people looking down into the Lockerbie crater. These are people standing by the Shanksville crater after the accident. Compare the size of a car with the Lockerbie crater and the size of a small truck with the crater in Shanksville. This is the largest chunk of the Pan Am flight that was found near Lockerbie. It's almost half the front part of the fuselage and includes part of the cockpit. This is the largest piece of debris we have ever seen from Shanksville. It's a piece of fuselage a bit wider than two passenger windows in a picture released 5 years after the event. This is an engine from Pan Am Flight 103, which plunged to the ground at a location near Lockerbie. This, we are told, is an engine from Flight 93, which was supposedly excavated from the hole in Shanksville. These are images from different crashes, showing that the tail of the plane almost always survives. It does so because it's normally the last part of the plane impacting the terrain, when most of the kinetic energy has already been dissipated to the ground. This is the mark on the ground that was supposedly left by the tail of Flight 93 before it vanished into thin air.
This is obviously a very visual section of the film, but I've left it in because it's worth thinking on, reflecting on the claim that not a single part of the plane survived the crash that was identifiably a plane. When the people arrived, the whole plane had somehow buried itself underground in a tiny hole, and then the earth had filled it in again so they couldn't even see any of the plane sticking out of the hole.
These are the chunks of the wings that are normally found after a plane crash. These are the marks that the wings of the plane allegedly left on the ground in Shanksville before vanishing with everything else into thin air. And this is the center of the hole, which is supposed to have swallowed practically the whole fuselage. But this is where the official story of the crash becomes truly fascinating. According to the FBI, after 2 weeks of excavation in Shanksville, 95% of the plane had been recovered. A Boeing 757 weighs roughly 100 tons. A mid-sized car weighs about 2,500 pounds, a ton and a half. This means that, according to the FBI, the equivalent of at least 50 to 60 cars was actually excavated from the ground. Question: can you explain how most of an airplane weighing 100 tons could end up buried deep underground in a hole that closed itself up before the first responders arrived? But even if it were true that 95% of the plane has been recovered, where is it? Why have we never been shown it? When a controversial accident happens, all efforts are made to recover as many pieces of the plane as possible. These, for example, are the remains of the flight from Lockerbie, which have been pieced together in a hangar. These are the remains of TWA 800, the flight that crashed in the ocean near Long Island in July 1996. These are the remains of Flight Itavia 870, which crashed in unclear circumstances near Ustica, Italy in 1980. Why wasn't the same thing done with United 93? Given the controversy on the absence of debris, coupled with the rumors of a possible shootdown, it would have been the perfect way to put all the conspiracy theories to rest. Instead, we are told, all the recovered parts of the plane have been sequestered by the FBI, and no one has ever been able to see them. As far as we know, Flight 93 might have never crashed in Shanksville to begin with. There is another problem for those who support the official version. When an airplane crashes to the ground, normally a plume of thick black smoke rises to the sky and continues to burn until all the fuel is consumed. But instead of being faced by something like that, this is what the people in Shanksville saw.
This is what we saw.
Das ist das, was wir gesehen haben. Sieht fast aus wie ein Pilz.
It looked like a mushroom cloud, he said. But under the cloud, there is no plume of black smoke rising to the sky. And the mushroom shape is the classic result of a bomb explosion. The same local reporter also noticed the absence of smell from burnt jet fuel and the odor of scorched earth instead.
And there's a very strong odor of the scorched earth. The only way I can describe it. It doesn't smell like jet fuel. It smells like... Kendall, how do you describe it?
Just burned earth.
Burned earth. It smells like burned earth.
The grass next to the hole also indicates there was no fire after the explosion, as it appears perfectly dry and untouched all around. Some have suggested that this is only the initial explosion, and that the plume of black smoke hasn't started to rise yet. But this hypothesis is disproven by this video, taken by a local amateur shortly after the explosion took place.
Crash over on Lambertsville Road.
As one can see, the initial cloud floats in the air, but the typical plume of black smoke rising from below is not there.
Don't know anything.
If we fast-forward the video, we can see that the situation doesn't change much. After more than 1 minute, the initial cloud is still there, but there is no black smoke whatsoever rising from below. Question: since the plane was carrying 8 to 10,000 gallons of fuel at the time of impact, can you explain why there is no plume of black smoke rising from the ground after the initial explosion? But the toughest problem for the supporters of the official version is to explain how different parts of debris could end up several miles away from the crash site, even though the plane is supposed to have hit the ground in one piece. William Bunch was a reporter for the Pittsburgh Gazette.
I gathered all the information I could quickly learned that there were a lot of things about the crash of Flight 93 that didn't really add up right away. The fact that debris fell on this lake a couple miles away at the same time that the plane was crashing.
The lake Bunch is talking about is Indian Lake, which is located a couple of miles southeast of the crash site. According to the debunkers, there is a valid explanation for the debris found in the lake.
When you talk about debris found who knows where, it went as far as Indian Lake, which is 1 mile away. They found small pieces of paper which had flown there because there was wind.
First of all, it's not true that there was wind on that day. As the images show, there was only a light breeze gently moving the air all around. The very cloud from the explosion, as we have seen before, practically didn't move for over 1 minute. Secondly, it wasn't just small pieces of paper that were found. From the Pittsburgh Tribune, we read, "By Wednesday morning, crash debris began washing ashore at the marina. Witness John Flegel said there was something that looked like a rib bone amid pieces of seats, small chunks of melted plastic, and checks." In any case, the problem is not limited to Indian Lake, which is 2 miles away from the crash site. Debris from the plane was found as far as 8 miles away, near New Baltimore. This is the map of the debris field published by the Pittsburgh Tribune. CNN also reported the secondary field, confirming that the debris belonged to Flight 93.
Well, Darren, in the last hour or so, the FBI and the state police here have confirmed that they have cordoned off a second area about 6 to 8 miles away from the crater here where this plane went down. This is apparently another debris site, which raises a number of questions. Why would debris from the plane, and they identified it specifically as being from this plane, why would debris be located 6 miles away? Could it have blown that far away? Seems highly unlikely. And as to whether it broke up on the way, we don't know that. FBI is being very tight-lipped about that. But again, it leads to that possibility. It certainly leads to a number of questions.
Since the plane is supposed to have hit the ground in one piece, can you explain how it was possible for debris to be found 6 to 8 miles from the crash site on a day when only a light breeze was blowing?
The shoot-down hypothesis.
The extension of the debris field is not the only fact suggesting a shoot-down. There are other elements that seem to confirm it.
John Flegel.
Standing there watching on TV, and the lights flickered in the building. About that time, we heard the engines roar, and we took off out of the building. As we were coming out from the office out through the building, the ground shook, and we heard, big boom. Looked over and saw the big ball of fire.
Flegel later told other people about the lights flickering.
I was in Atlanta, and I was sitting there talking to another guy, and I was explaining to him about whenever we were standing in the office and the lights flickered and everything. And as soon as he heard me say that, he immediately stopped me and he said, "Well, I'm retired from the Air Force." He said, "That plane was shot down." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because whenever the lights flickered, they zapped the radar frequency on everything before they shoot."
The mayor of Indian Lake also remembers the power going off just before the crash.
"Our power had gone off, and then we felt a tremor. It sounded like a missile came across our house. I mean, they were going that fast."
The mayor of Shanksville had something interesting to say. "I know of two people, I will not mention names, that heard a missile," Stuhl said. "They both live very close, within a couple of hundred yards. This one fellow served in Vietnam, and he says he's heard them, and he heard one that day. But who could have possibly shot the plane down? As far as we know, there are no witnesses who saw fighter jets near Flight 93 at the time of the crash. There are, however, some witnesses who saw a small, unmarked white plane which flew over the area just before the crash.
Susan McElwain, an eyewitness half a mile from the crash scene.
I was just driving along here. It was a beautiful day. Had my window open. Had the stereo on. And when I got up here almost to the stop sign, this small white plane, at the time, that's what I thought it was, went over top of me. It was so smooth, and it just glided right over me, just like that. And then I ducked, and when I looked up again, then it just banked to the right and went over and went down behind those trees.
Viola Saylor.
Something caught my eye, and here it was a white plane, and it was coming from the crash site area.
The debunkers maintain that there is no mystery behind the white plane. It was a corporate jet, they say, which air traffic controllers had asked to take a look on the ground after they realized they had lost Flight 93.
There was, in fact, a little white jet that was seen in the area after Flight 93 crashed. A number of witnesses saw it. It was a little Dassault Falcon corporate jet that was flying to a nearby airport. And what happened is once air traffic control knew they had lost Flight 93, they asked the nearest aircraft to go over the area and actually radio back exact coordinates for the crash site.
No.
Susan McElwain, however, remembers seeing the white plane before the crash, not after.
About 11:30 that night, the FBI came, wanted to talk to me. They kept asking me how big the plane was. I said the plane, you know, it was small, wasn't much bigger than my van that I saw, and that it went over top of me. And I said, you want to make sure maybe it was ours and not somebody else's. And then that's when he did seem to get a little nicer. Told me that it was a white Learjet. Someone was taking pictures. I said, before the crash? And he says, well, we got to go.
John Flegel also saw the mysterious plane. Since Flegel arrived on the spot within a minute from the crash, the corporate jet sent by the air traffic controllers would not have had time to descend over the area yet, while the mystery plane was already getting away from the spot into the blue sky.
We got there, like I said, probably within 45 seconds or a minute of impact. We were there. We were there before any firemen, any paramedics, or anybody. We were on site. When we got there, there was a plane flying up above. And he was smart. He flew straight for the sun. So you couldn't look at it and see exactly what type of plane or if it was a fighter or what it was. But, you know, we caught a glimpse of it. And as he was swinging, he was basically traveling in the same direction as the plane.
If the plane was actually shot down, one big question arises. What are we to make of the heroic gesture by the passengers who chose to force the plane to the ground, we are told, in order to save the lives of other fellow countrymen? In truth, this heroic gesture by the passengers has been refuted by the 9/11 Commission itself. It was the hijackers, wrote the commission, and not the passengers, who chose to intentionally crash the plane in Shanksville. The passengers never even made it into the cockpit. From the final report, we read, at 9:57, the passenger assault began. But for more than 5 minutes, writes the commission, the passengers were unable to break into the cockpit. After a while, as the outside attack continued, Girard asked, is that it? Shall we finish it off? A hijacker responded, no, not yet. When they all come, we finish it off. It should be noted that this dialogue was allegedly extracted from the cockpit voice recorder of Flight 93, but the actual recording, as we have said before, was never played in public. At 10:02, a hijacker said, pull it down, pull it down. The hijackers remained at the controls, but must have judged that the passengers were only seconds from overcoming them. The airplane headed down, the control wheel was turned hard to the right. The airplane rolled onto its back, and one of the hijackers began shouting, Allah is the greatest, Allah is the greatest. With the sound of the passenger counterattack continuing, the aircraft plowed into an empty field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania at 580 miles per hour. About 20 minutes flight time from Washington, D.C. Girard's objective, concludes the commission, was to crash the airliner into symbols of the American Republic, the Capitol, or the White House. Question. Given that they were only 20 minutes away from Washington, and for almost 6 minutes the passengers had been unable to enter the cockpit, why didn't the hijackers continue flying towards the Capitol? And even if they thought they couldn't make it to Washington, why didn't they try to crash the plane onto a small town nearby? Why crash the plane in an empty field where they knew they could not kill any more victims than those that were already on the plane with them? Maybe a less fictional explanation for Flight 93 is the one offered by Vernon Groves, author and former NTSB investigator.
The role the government plays in times of stress, how they view the public. Can the public stand the truth? Or shouldn't we? We need a legend at this point. We need a really neat story of reacting against such a dastardly act as was happening. So it's really nice and convenient to think of the Beamer story, Let's Roll. And that becomes just like the Alamo. And it's just one of those legends. And I think there'll be a lot of pressure to let the legend stay where it is.
If we now summarize Flight 93, we have no proof whatsoever that the terrorists boarded the plane, nor that they were ever in the cockpit. An alleged hijacker who could not have flown an airliner in the way that Flight 93 was flown. A false, concurrent hijacking that called the attention away from the real one. No proof whatsoever that Flight 93 crashed in the field near Shanksville. An extended debris field, which flatly disproves the official version of the crash and suggests that the plane broke up in mid-air instead. An unexplained small white jet leaving the area right after the impact. And the fact that the passengers who called from their cell phones could not have been on that plane to begin with, which strongly suggests their revolt was a scripted, fictional event intended to fuel a prefabricated legend.
Part 6. The Twin Towers.
I can't see any air anymore.
Okay.
All I see is smoke.
Smoke rises to the roof. There we're on the floor. We're in a window. Can't see.
Can you stay on the line with me, please?
Yes, ma'am. I am.
I'm going to die, aren't I?
No. Say your...
I'm going to die.
Ma'am, say your prayers.
Thank God to blow your wind from the left.
Help!
Ma'am?
Help!
What the hell happened?
Oh, my God.
Oh, God!
For most Americans, the destruction of the Twin Towers will remain embedded in their memories and their hearts as the epitome of horror, astonishment, and unjustified human suffering. But for some, it may have represented the moment where large corporate interests of global reach and cynical economic greed found the perfect place for a secret encounter. Common wisdom has it that the September 11 attacks destroyed two of the best jewels America has ever had. But exactly jewels, the Twin Towers, were not. While they sat on some of the most valuable real estate in the world, after 30 years the Twin Towers had become obsolete. With each of the floors built as an open space of almost 1 acre in size, the rising cost of energy had made it extremely expensive to keep the buildings warm in winter and cool in summer. General maintenance was also very expensive compared to buildings from more recent years. In his 1999 book on the Twin Towers, Divided We Stand, author Eric Darton wrote, "When the World Trade Center was bombed in February 1993, it was already passing its prime as office space, overtaken by a generation of more recent, cybernetically smart buildings with higher ceilings and greater built-in electrical capacity. To maintain the Trade Center as Class A office space commanding top rents, the Port Authority would have had to spend $800 million rebuilding its electrical, electronic communications, and cooling systems." Furthermore, after the 1993 bombing, the tenancy had dropped dramatically, and it had been very hard to bring it back to normal levels. But the biggest problem with the Twin Towers was the large amount of asbestos they contained. Built in a time when the use of asbestos was still allowed in civil construction, at least 400 tons of this extremely dangerous material had been used to fireproof the steel structure of the buildings and to insulate hundreds of miles of pipings for water, heating, and air conditioning. Asbestos was also present in the ceiling panels, the elevator shafts, and the vinyl tiles from office floors. From a property condition assessment of the Twin Towers dated December 2000, we read, "According to Port Authority records, a total of 7 million square feet of vinyl asbestos floor tiles were installed in the World Trade Center. By the time asbestos was banned from civil construction, the Twin Towers were nearing their completion. Initially, the asbestos was encapsulated wherever possible to prevent the particles from being inhaled. But in the 1990s, the regulations grew tighter, and every time a simple renovation was needed, the complete removal and replacement of the asbestos was also required. At At the same time, because of the health risk it posed, the cost of asbestos removal and abatement had been skyrocketing. Safety procedures required the areas to be treated to be vacated in advance, hermetically sealed, and kept under negative pressure at all times to prevent particles from escaping outside. Only specialized workers could access the area, wearing airtight suits and respirators. A full decontamination process was required every time they left the area. In the mid-90s, the Port Authority put out different bids for the removal and replacement of the asbestos in a case-by-case scenario. For example, this is a 1995 contract for the installation of two low-voltage substations in Towers 1 and 2. One section in the contract listed the replacement of asbestos at floors 41, 42, 75, and 76 in Tower 1 and floors 75 and 76 in Tower 2. Total cost for the asbestos removal and replacement? $868,000. Tower 2, 40th floor. Contract for asbestos removal and abatement? Total cost, $650,000. Towers 1 and 2, removal of asbestos and new ceilings at floors 7, 41, and 75. Total cost, $882,000. It soon became clear that the Twin Towers were quickly turning from a prestigious asset into a serious liability. From the December 2000 condition assessment, we read, from 1986 to 1999, a total 31 contracts were bid, and a total of $58.2 million was spent in abatement projects. By then, 3.5 million square feet of vinyl asbestos floor tile was removed, only half of the initial 7 million square feet installed. At the estimated cost of $5 to $6 per square foot, that accounted for an additional $20 million in cost for the Port Authority, and that was for the floor tiles only. There were also hundreds of thousands of square feet of spray-on fireproofing to be removed throughout both buildings. And then there were the elevators. This is the list of elevator shafts with asbestos-containing material as of December 2000. Reportedly, by the year 2000, the Port Authority was looking at an asbestos abatement bill of as much as $1 billion, the same money it would have cost to build a brand new tower. Back in the 90s, the Port Authority had sued the insurance companies, trying to get them to cover the cost of the asbestos removal. But in May 2001, 4 months before the terrorist attack, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey lost their 10-year-old court battle. At that point, the Port Authority was between a rock and a hard place. The Twin Towers could no longer be maintained without incurring the cost of asbestos removal, yet they could not be demolished because of the large amounts of asbestos they contained. The only remaining option was to dismantle and remove the two poison-filled giants one piece at a time. But the cost of such an operation would have been so astronomical that no one has ever tried to put a number on it. Luckily for all, the stalemate was broken when a real estate tycoon named Larry Silverstein, who already owned Building 7, offered to purchase a 99-year lease for the Twin Towers.
76 years old, and look at him go. He walks fast, talks fast, and is always, always selling.
Silverstein seemed in a big hurry to close the deal. Even though he had been hospitalized for a car accident during the bidding operations, he asked his doctors to take him off the morphine so the deal could be finalized.
So I told the doctor, I said, kill the morphine, and I got to get my people.
And there's over an hour of that film left, but to cover another base, I thought we'd hear a little bit about the 9/11 Commission. It's quite amazing how much stuff nowadays is hidden in plain sight. It's never reported by the commercially controlled media, the same media that blacked out World Trade Center 7 for years, but it's on the official record. So, as a quick answer to people who have been programmed to say that couldn't have been a conspiracy because somebody would have said something by now if it had been, well, there is the case of Max Cleland, former 9/11 commissioner. You're just going to hear briefly his summary. This is from March 2004.
Truth of the matter is, the White House has played cover-up.
So, if he was on the 9/11 Commission and says the White House played cover-up, does that count as somebody saying something? Well, Cleland had resigned in 2003 from the 9/11 Commission, and he was replaced by Bob Kerry, another man to be commended for his surprising frankness, because when confronted by We Are Change LA's Jeremy Rotherkuschel, this is what he had to say.
Why didn't they talk about Building 7 in the report?
That's good.
Why do you think that was?
I don't have an easy answer for you. No. I would ask it one time.
Can you see this medical thing right now?
Yeah. Anyway,
thank
you.
Do
you support a criminal investigation into 9/11? Because I know yours was an exposition. It was not a criminal investigation.
I don't think so, but I don't know. I mean, I do support a permanent commission to examine not just that, but lots of other things in this area. So.
But if it's a permanent cover-up, then if it's an act of war and it's hiding things, which everyone on your commission knew that the Pentagon was changing their stories, lying to you, right. And it's a cover-up of an act of war, and under Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution, it's treason. So unless we get to the very bottom of it, then we're still talking a treasonous exposition.
This is a longer conversation. I'm not sure you ever get to the bottom of it.
We have to, or we can't save our countries.
I don't think, well, if that's the condition upon which we're going to be saving our country, I don't. Because the problem is, it's a 30-year-old conspiracy. It's,
no, I'm talking about 9/11.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, you are. You mean
at
this?
Yeah. Anyway, I got it.
Okay, be well.
Okay, thanks.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that's one member of the 9/11 Commission resigning, claiming it's a whitewash. And one member who went through later stating on camera, with a knowing smile, that 9/11 is a 30-year conspiracy. Is the commercially controlled media interested in this? About as interested that the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee is charging conspiracy as regards the anthrax attacks. So, what to do? Well, I think it's important to first see that lack of evidence is not really what's stopping people from understanding how much they've been lied to. There's a tremendous amount of evidence out there. Emotional attachment to the status quo is a big one that we shouldn't overlook. Behind people's claim, oh, well, somebody would have said something if there'd been a conspiracy, is the hope that there is no conspiracy and they can just get on with their own lives. And the possibly implicit belief that if anybody with credible evidence had appeared, knocked on the door of the BBC or the New York Times or any of the commercially controlled media, the self-styled, remember, self-styled mainstream media, that they would have been taken seriously and their opinions would have been given a hearing. Instead of which, we have this sort of self-referential, well, nobody's talking about it, so it can't make any sense. Except, of course, when we say nobody's talking about it, that's increasingly valueless. Although repeated, the claim being that it's a fringe belief, say that Lee Harvey Oswald was part of something larger, whereas in fact most people in the US don't believe he was a lone nut. In fact, the position of the US government is that it's extremely unlikely, I think the phrase was very high probability, of a conspiracy. That's the finding of the US House Committee on Assassinations. So what is this mainstream if it doesn't reflect the majority opinion? And it doesn't even reflect the government's opinion, according to their own official documents. It's a consensus trance. It's pretty much what big money would like it to be, and not a lot else. So, bearing all of that in mind, how to get through to people? I wouldn't be making this show if I had given up on the idea of getting through to people. I realise that many regular listeners are more or less on the team as far as being highly critical of what big money would have us believe. But there are people out there who are maybe uncertain. I'd encourage you to download and watch the film, by the way, because I've just put part 2 on the website, as I would encourage you to download any previous episodes of this radio show, all available for free from the MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. We have a Twitter feed at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests, and the media I use to make this show, as usual, are available for download from its webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/678. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.